You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on Irritable Bowel Syndrome, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Lin Chang. Dr. Chang is the co-director of the G. Oppenheimer Center for Neurobiology of Stress and Resilience and vice chief of the Vache and Tamara Manoukian Division of Digestive Diseases at UCLA. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers. This podcast is intended only for U.S. healthcare professionals.
Hello, I'm Dr. Lin Chang, and welcome to Medscape's In Discussion series on IBS. Today, we'll be discussing the role of the microbiome in IBS and the related topics of post-infection IBS, post-COVID and long-COVID IBS with Dr. Madhu Grover. Dr. Grover is an associate professor of medicine and physiology and consultant in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology in the Department of Internal Medicine at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Welcome to In Discussion. Madhu, thanks so much for joining us today. It's so great to have you. You're an expert in this field, and I'm sure our listeners will love to hear what you have to say and to provide your expertise on this pretty complicated topic of IBS.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I want to start off with having you tell us, how did you become interested in IBS?
Yeah, so this sort of dates back now almost 15 years ago. I was still an internal medicine resident, and I chose to work with Doug Grossman and Bill Whitehead at University of North Carolina. Really got interested in the whole space of neurogastroenterology, just the biopsychosocial context of addressing how we think about these disorders, how we address and treat them. And from there, the journey sort of started where I wanted to push the envelope and really get into understanding these disorders so that we can design more effective treatments in future.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And you also started getting more involved in the mechanisms or pathophysiology related to microbiome and IBS. How did you specifically get interested in just the microbiome part?
Absolutely. So that was one of the reasons, after spending time at UNC, I decided to come to Mayo Clinic where we have unique opportunities to engage in translational research. And one of the phenotypes that intrigued me clinically was this phenotype of post-infection irritable bowel syndrome. You know, when we talk about IBS, we always wonder how one gets it. And I thought looking at this phenotype would be really intriguing because it gives us an opportunity to identify individuals who were normal really before the infection, you know, get hit by a foodborne illness from which 80 to 90% folks are expected to recover, but then 10% don't, and they develop these long-term symptoms, which can be pretty disabling. So that was my journey in that sort of niche where I could identify patients over long-term and really follow them to understand what are the mechanisms that are driving it. To answer your question in more specific detail, is the microbiome was still emerging as a key player. This was now, 7 or 8 years ago when we were getting some initial understanding of really how is the microbiome changed in irritable bowel syndrome. But still it was unclear how these changes may affect how IBS may develop. And, you know, that question of cause and effect comes into picture, whether the changes in microbiome are a result of IBS or vice versa. So with the post-infection IBS, since we were able to identify these individuals early on, right away after infection, and follow them over time, we could really longitudinally understand how the microbiome is changing and really tie it more closely towards development of post-infection IBS.
Yeah, so to clarify, post-infection IBS is where an individual doesn't have any IBS symptoms. Initially, they get this infection in the gut, and the infection clears, even though they may think, I still have this infection, but they often don't. And then they get these symptoms of IBS, and they could last a fair amount of time. What's the natural history of post-infection IBS? Because a lot of patients don't have a previous infection. That's just one of the risk factors to getting IBS. But does that have a different trajectory and natural history than patients who don't have post-infection IBS? They just have IBS?
Yeah, that's a great question, Dr. Chang. So with post-infection IBS, now there have been some studies that have followed these individuals up to 8 to 10 years after infection. And we have learned a few things about post-infection IBS. One, over years, there is a fraction of, you know, patients who really clear their IBS symptoms. So if you have a large cohort identified, for example, the Walkerton outbreak cohort from Canada, where sewage contaminated the water supply, a lot of individuals unfortunately developed acute gastroenteritis. And now they have been followed all the way up to 10 years. And what we are learning is that more and more, you know, patients clear their IBS over time. We also have natural history studies looking at viral-related post-infection IBS. And there, the observation is that within the first 1 to 2 years, the IBS phenotype clears versus bacterial or protozoal, where the symptoms can last for a very long time. It is not to say that every person with post-infection IBS would recover after 8 or 10 years. It is to say that some of them would. We still don't have good ways of telling who are those individuals who continue to have symptoms versus those who clear their infection or their IBS. We also have another observation from our recent study where folks who have pre-existing IBS, particularly IBS with constipation, if they get an infection, they sometimes develop diarrhea. So not only the IBS has to happen as a new onset after infection, but even folks who had a previous IBS, their IBS can change. Many a times their IBS can become more severe after having an infection. So a number of things can happen as a result of infection.
Yeah, I definitely see that in patients who have IBS and then they get an infection. And maybe their family gets it and they said, gee, my family has gotten better. I'm not better, you know, because they have an underlying GI infection. But that's interesting to think that people who have predominantly constipation now switch to diarrhea. Is your observation that they stay with diarrhea for a while or do they switch back to constipation eventually?
Yeah, we haven't followed these folks for that amount of time or since the, you know, the first identification of their IBS. What we do know that with post-infection IBS, constipation is extremely rare. So now we have, you know, thousands of patients in our cohort, and I would say only 2 to 3% are constipation. Rest are actually either diarrhea or mixed. And often, as you know, clinically, you know, many a times folks with diarrhea tend to have a mixed phenotype when they have alternating diarrhea and constipation. Sometimes they can come back to that diarrhea phenotype, but I have not seen constipation being a predominant issue after infection or in the post-infection IBS subtype.
Now, a lot of us have had GI infections, you know, food poisoning, but we all don't get IBS. So what are the risk factors of getting that post-infection IBS?
So a few years ago, I did a meta-analysis looking at a number of studies over the last 15 years or so. And we concluded that females, for example, are at higher risk of developing post-infection IBS. Younger individuals are at higher risk, which also is true for more garden variety IBS, where we see females and young folks getting it more commonly. Those who were hospitalized during infection or had a greater severity of infection are also at high risk. So we do know some of these factors. There was also some work really interesting looking at the effect of stress during or in the preceding months before infection, things like anxiety, depression, somatization, and these factors were also associated with an increased risk of development of post-infection IBS.
Yeah, it just shows the importance of the brain-gut axis and how there's an interplay and, you know, a dynamic process between them, that you can have some of these environmental factors like stress or anxiety, and that increases your risk when the insult is really in the gut or it started in the gut. So it shows that importance. So is there any treatment that's different, or do you approach the management of patients with post-infection IBS differently than patients who don't, who just have, say, garden variety IBS? Is there any evidence for a different treatment?
Yeah, so I'm going to answer that question sort of a two-pronged approach. One is when I see an individual with post-infection IBS, and one can wonder, how do I know? Because often, as you know, an infection is not proven by a laboratory testing. It's often this history when somebody was traveling someplace or ate something strange and they got sick for 2 or 3 days when they distinctly remember that they were quite miserable for a few days. So that's often a clue to, okay, that may have been that infection episode that may have led to their post-infection IBS. So I think always getting into that history, trying to understand if they truly remember something about how the symptoms of IBS started. And often when you ask that leading question, you will get that answer. So when I see that in the history, first thing I do is I try to explain this concept of post-infection IBS to that patient, because, you know, it's really reassuring to the patients and also, you know, helps them put their symptoms in context when they know, okay, there is a connection between my gut getting injured at the time of that infection and how a small percentage of patients can develop long-term symptomatology. So I think that explanation really hits it home for them when they, you know, try to put their symptoms in context. I also share with them some of these data that we talked about, how in some patients over time, you know, particularly if the injury is driven by a virus, symptoms may actually disappear over the course of 1 or 2 years. I tell them, we don't know whether that's going to be the case for you, but there is a chance that that can happen, that over time your symptoms may improve or they even resolve. So I think those two things I use often clinically. As far as treatments are concerned, there have been, unfortunately, not a lot of clinical trials that have looked at post-infection IBS as a unique entity for enrollment, except for one recent study that was published by Tulane, you know, colleagues, looking at glutamine, for example, and how that can influence symptoms in folks who have post-infection IBS. And not only they took those individuals, but they also, you know, measured their urinary, you know, excretion of sugars, which is an assay for intestinal permeability. And they selected for patients who have increased intestinal permeability. And when you take that specialized cohort of patients and, you know, put them through a randomized trial of glutamine, you see that there is a very high success rate. So again, we need more studies replicating that original pivotal trial. But I think that's sort of what we are looking at on the horizon if we think about post-infection IBS. There have been some smaller studies looking at anti-inflammatory agents like mesalamine, which is used for inflammatory bowel disease. Again, not everybody with post-infection IBS gets better, but there is clearly a group within post-infection IBS that shows remarkable improvement in symptoms. So, you know, not to say that we are there yet with some of these agents, but I think slowly data is emerging. Clinically, I still tend to treat them as routine IBS, where I try to look at what is the influence of pain in their symptomatology, what is the predominant bowel phenotype. If it's diarrhea, I might start off with regular antidiarrheals. Often we try low FODMAPs diet in a selected group of patients over a short course to see if their symptoms might improve.
You touched on something really important, and you and I both learned that from Doug Drossman, is conveying information to the patient so they understand more about their condition. And I like glutamine a lot. I've used that as well. But also for IBS with diarrhea patients, not only post-infection, because there was some original data that showed it could work in that subgroup as well. Well, I want to move on to post-COVID IBS, which is newer. That's a virus that's been associated with IBS-like symptoms. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, so that's, we are, you know, obviously getting that as a question a lot these days in the clinic, where folks who had COVID are experiencing both either new onset of GI symptoms or worsening of their you know, pre-existing GI symptoms. So now a number of studies have looked at what is the prevalence of these symptoms over the next 1 to 2 years after COVID. And I would say that the literature is a bit mixed. When you look at uncontrolled studies, where you just try to ask a bunch of people who had COVID about you know, any GI symptoms at the moment, there's a big range, anywhere from 3% all the way to 50% in some studies are reporting some sort of GI symptoms. Recently, there was a meta-analysis that looked at around 10 studies, close to 4,000 patients. And they found that in an uncontrolled setting, about 13 to 14% were reporting IBS or IBS-like symptoms. Now, if you look at controlled studies, which happens quite a bit, as you know, where you take individuals with infection and without infection, and you try to understand an odds ratio that way, the data is a bit more mixed. And I think it varies from setting to setting. There was a recent study published by Giovanni Barbera and you know, colleagues, when they looked at hospitalized patients. So again, within COVID, this was a specialized group that was hospitalized, close to 600 cases, close to 300 controls. and they got an odds ratio of around 1.8 for IBS development. They also interestingly found that constipation was less frequent in those who had COVID versus controls. So again, kind of bringing back that point that diarrheal symptoms are, you know, likely to happen more often. There was another study from India that found that close to 7% individuals after infection were endorsing symptoms of IBS. So I think as we learn more about this and we get larger studies representing a variety of different geographic settings, we will get to, you know, be able to conclude a bit more definitively. But I won't be surprised if there is a risk that is present as compared to controls. But I also think, honestly, just like we see the experience with norovirus or some of these other viruses, it's also likely that COVID-related IBS may be shorter lasting than what you might experience with E. coli or Campylobacter. Again, I have no data at this moment to be able to conclusively say that, but this is extrapolating experience from other viruses.
And the risk factors for getting post-COVID IBS, I've read data where if you have gastrointestinal symptoms at the time of COVID, you're more likely to get post-COVID IBS. Are there other risk factors, or what do you think about that? Or are there other risk factors like we've seen in post-infection IBS?
Yeah, that's a great question. Again, I think all the studies that I have looked at, that has been a consistent theme. GI symptoms at the time of infection seems to emerge as a consistent predictive factor for development of long-lasting GI symptoms consistent with IBS. Again, some of the studies also found that females are at higher risk. Another study found that if individuals required oxygen or they had dyspnea as a symptom during COVID, they were at higher risk, higher CRP. So again, we are seeing some similarities where if they were sicker, they are more likely to develop. An intriguing study also found that if they have higher levels in the blood of procalcitonin, that was perhaps an indicative of development of post-infection IBS. So again, we're going to learn more about this, but we are seeing some similarities with post-infection IBS. But as you said, GI symptoms at the time of infection should be our top line symptom as we think about a person who is suffering from IBS-like symptoms after COVID.
It's interesting to think that, you know, it definitely sounds like the more severe illness you have in general, you're more at risk for post-COVID IBS. But it's interesting that you said that you can have more respiratory symptoms, not necessarily GI symptoms, and you can still get that. We talked a lot about post-infection causes of IBS, but what is your thought about just the microbiome in general in health and in disease? Because it's not only related to infection. So what's your perspective on that?
Yeah. So, you know, microbiome science has really evolved, as you know, within the last decade even, right? When we were really doing studies which were cross-sectional, looking at disease versus controls, and we were in this era when we were trying to understand how the microbiome is changed in a disease, such as IBS. Then over the last 3 or 4 years, we have started to learn how a single time point assessment may not give you the complete picture. So in IBS, work done by Purna Kashyap and colleagues, where they have collected stool samples longitudinally, what we learn is that there is a lot of fluctuation from month to month in the microbiome in feces in these IBS patients. And perhaps more sampling can give you a more conclusive or a better framework to think about what's really changed. So we know that's not enough. We can't just stop at saying, oh, this microbe is more or less. And that's been happening over the last, I would say, 4 to 5 years, when the studies are now trying to ask the question, how does this relate to the pathophysiology of IBS? And when we think about pathophysiology of IBS, we know that folks have either changes in their sensation or sensory system, what we also tend to describe as visceral hypersensitivity. There are then subset of patients who have altered transit, which may result in them experiencing diarrhea or constipation. And we're also learning about increased intestinal permeability and how that may affect how the symptoms are, experienced and generated. So we, in fact, in our studies with post-infection IBS patients, we are doing all these three tests in these individuals in our clinical research. And one of the messages that we are getting from those studies is that there truly is an evidence of increased colonic permeability in these patients. In our case, we take Campylobacter infection because we want to keep our studies a bit more focused towards one infection type, but there have been other studies that have looked at other infections as well. So now what we are doing as an extension of that work is trying to link these microbes and changes to the intestinal permeability changes we see. And one of the themes we have discovered over the last few years is regulation of molecules called proteases in the gut. These are molecules that conventionally are hurtful to the colon, or they disrupt the colonic barrier, increase permeability. But if you have a healthy microbiome, which has all the healthy members, it really is able to suppress those proteases, those microbes. What happens in post-infection irritable bowel syndrome is some of those key microbes are lost, most likely as a result of that injury. And these individuals are not able to regain those microbes. We know from longitudinal studies that once lost, they are not coming back. And we know then what happens is those proteases don't get suppressed like they do in healthy. So as this is just one example of how some of the recent studies have been trying to link infection, resulting changes in microbiota, and how they may influence some of these molecules in the gut that can cause a long-lasting kind of chronic injury.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean, it just tells you how complex it is, because people also think a lot of microbiome and IBS about being too much bacteria, like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which a lot of people are very aware of. What is your take on SIBO or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and utilizing breath tests for IBS?
That's been a question that has been in the field for a long period of time. Small bowel is very, very important. That's where the nutrients get first before they make their way into the colon. I believe that a subset of patients perhaps do have small bowel dysbiosis. That's the term I like to use, not particularly overgrowth. And what that really means is that microbiota composition in their small bowel is not the right kind. It's not talking to the host the right way, which influences symptoms. The way we test bacterial overgrowth right now with breath testing is perhaps not the right way of doing it. And studies have shown that. For example, if you really take microbes from the small bowel and sequence them, you are much more likely to get a better clue into this dysbiosis rather than just measuring them and their amount, which is what some of the breath testing does. Breath testing is also a bit flawed because it can be affected by the transit or the motility of the gut. So a lot of time, what we interpret as a positive breath test is in fact those sugars reaching the colon and the colonic flora causing that breath test to turn positive. So I think it's an entity which exists in a very small percentage of IBS patients, but I don't think we have the right tests that are clinically available at this time to diagnose that.
Okay, well, that's really helpful. I want to close with what do you envision as possible microbiome-targeted therapies in the future?
I think the microbiome-targeted therapies, particularly for IBS, are going to be personalized. I think we are not going to be able to have a one-size-fits-all approach. We do know microbiome varies from, you know, individual to another individual. So just trying to use one kind of microbiota to treat all IBS patients is likely not going to be helpful. And we know this from IBS studies in general. It's a heterogeneous disorder, and it's likely that different alterations drive symptoms in different subsets of IBS patients. So I think the future is going to be identifying those subsets that have a microbiome-driven mechanism and try to give them the right microbiome. And we are seeing this with some of the fecal microbiota transplantation studies, where if you take selected microbiota as the donor, it works much better than taking unselected microbiome from just anybody. And we also are learning that only a subset of patients show an improvement after any of these therapies. So I think the future is going to be looking at what microbes are being given and to whom are they being given. I am also intrigued by some of the advancements made in the area of prebiotics. So when we think about microbiota and how we can alter it, we always think about giving microbiota, right? But you can also give non-viable things, particularly dietary interventions like fructooligosaccharides, galacto-oligosaccharides, which interface with unique microbes and produce things that can be helpful for the host. So I think in the future, we're going to learn more about prebiotics, which are these dietary, you know, components which are used by certain microbes, along with probiotics. And this is the idea with synbiotics. When you look at what microbe you are trying to replace or provide and what is the right kind of diet for that microbe and how they can both interact to help the person.
Yeah, this is so fascinating. I mean, your knowledge has been really enlightening. It's so great to hear this. It's really fascinating to think of what's going to be out there in the future. I mean, there's so many possibilities, which makes it exciting for research, but also for clinical care. So thank you so much to Dr. Grover for discussing the microbiome and its relation in IBS, in particular post-infection IBS, post-COVID IBS, and just what's the future in research and treatment. So thank you so much for joining us. This is Dr. Lin Chang for In Discussion.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Irritable Bowel Syndrome podcast series with our host, Dr. Lin Chang. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on irritable bowel syndrome.